Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another issue here of Beyond the Cover, hosted by John Robb and Jeff Ayers. Jeff, how you doing tonight, my man?
Doing fantastic.
Awesome. Tonight we got a fabulous show for you. We have author Grant Blackwood, who is going to be joining us, who has just written the next book in the Tom Clancy Universe series of the Jack Ryan Jr. called Under Fire, comes out tomorrow. And then we were supposed to have Nelson DeMille last 2 weeks ago. That didn't quite work out, but we still were able to interview Nelson DeMille. We're going to play that interview in the second half of the show right after everything else. So let's not waste any further time here. Let's just jump right into it, and let's bring on our guest, Mr. Grant Blackwood. So, Grant, thanks so much for coming on, my man. How you doing?
Evening, guys. Nice to talk to you.
And
thanks
like
for
we talked a little off the air, so hopefully you're in a little air conditioning, got a little hot weather we got coming up here in the West Coast. But it's a perfect backdrop now for the latest book that's coming out. Like we said, it's written into the Tom Clancy universe. Of course, he's passed away some years back. And you have now written the latest in the Jack Ryan Jr. book called Under Fire, comes out tomorrow. So why don't you jump in a little bit and let us know about this and to let people know that, you know, the series is alive and kicking, and you're taking the reins.
The series is alive and kicking. It really started with Teeth of the Tiger, where Jack Ryan Jr. and the Campus, this kind of off-the-books intelligence organization, came into being. And there's about a seven-year gap between Teeth of the Tiger and then the book that I wrote with Tom Clancy, Dead or Alive. And that kind of rebooted the Campus and Jack Ryan Jr. And since then, between me and Mark Greeney, we've kind of really kept the series going, and I know it's an honor for me, and I'm sure it is for him.
Now, how did you, I guess, when Clancy passed away, how did you and Mark get to continue to keep writing these books?
Well, I think, you know, the idea is even before he passed away, the talk was they wanted to expand the Tom Clancy brand. Not he was already very big, but wanted to kind of maximize the impact he had, not only in the publishing world in general, but the thriller genre. And so there had been talks about doing more than one Clancy book a year. And as that ball started rolling, and then he passed away, his estate kind of took over, and they continued with that effort.
Okay. Now, like you mentioned, it has been some years since the last book was out for Jack Ryan Jr., and now it's coming out tomorrow, which is very, very exciting. What are fans going to notice, if anything, between the breaks between books and kind of how the series is? Is there anything that they're going to notice? Is there anything that's changed in maybe your writing style that has kind of, you know, progressed now over the years?
You know, I hope not. Well, I hope so and I hope not, because Mark and I, we really try to create this kind of seamless universe between what happened in Teeth of the Tiger and then Dead or Alive and where Jack Ryan Jr. is today. And that's part of what we're tasked with, is carrying on this legacy of giving Tom Clancy fans as close to a Tom Clancy experience as we can. In Dead or Alive, you know, the arc you're going to see is that Jack Ryan Jr. in Dead or Alive went from analyst to field operative, and he was kind of thrown into a really dicey situation. He kind of jumped into the deep end of the pool. In the intervening years, he's had a lot of field work. So the Jack Ryan Jr. you're going to see in Under Fire is well-matured, very well-trained. He's kind of come into his own, but this time he is largely on his own. He's in the field, living by his own wits and training the resources. He's got some help from the Campus, but this is a very personal, down and dirty, nitty gritty book with Jack Ryan Jr.
And having read it, I really enjoyed it immensely. And all our listeners should go pick it up right now, or tomorrow when they can.
You can pre-order it.
That's true.
Pre-orders are wonderful.
A lot of things that John and I talk about on the show is author branding, and I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about author branding.
Well, you know, author branding is something that I won't say all authors shoot for, but it is essentially, the way I look at it is this. When the author's name becomes much, much bigger than the title of the book, that is kind of coincides with the fact that people are not buying that particular book because of the title or what the story is about. They're buying it for the author's name because that author has a great track record of entertaining them. And so that's sort of franchising. There are other things that go into the mix as far as number of fans you have and sales figures, but that's kind of how I look at it, is if people start buying your book just because your name is on the cover and they trust you to deliver, then you're a franchise.
And now, speaking of that, because, you know, you're on branding and you're writing under in a universe that is extremely popular with Tom Clancy, of course, probably one of the most famous military writers with the video games and everything else that he had going on within that whole merchandising aspect. How did you feel the pressure maybe when you first started doing it, and do you continue to still feel that pressure every time a new book comes out? Do you kind of feel that way?
You know, to be honest, I don't feel a lot of added pressure. I am keenly aware about what we're tasked with. You know, this is it's not a burden, but it's certainly something that is always in the forefront of our mind, that we're carrying on the Clancy franchise along with the publisher and everybody in the Clancy estate. I think it makes it easier for me that Dead or Alive did so well. It spent, mm-hmm. I think, 3 weeks at number one at Christmas when it came out. And so having felt like I really got up to speed and I was hit the ground running with Dead or Alive, all I really needed to concentrate on was telling the best Clancy-esque story I could. And I knew it was going to be a very personal Jack Ryan book, and that's kind of what guided me.
Well, you not only have written in the Clancy universe, you've also written for Clive Cussler and James Rollins. And I'm wondering, how did you get involved working with those other authors?
You know, it's strange. When you start your career out and you get your first publishing deal, I think all authors kind of have this plan. I think that this is the way my career is going to go. And mine took a little bit of a detour, and a wonderful one, actually, when I ended up co-authoring first with Clive and then Tom Clancy. And it became one of those things that some people you really admire, especially Clive, they come around, they say, you know, not only do we want to work with you, but we want to pay you to do what you love for a living. And that's pretty cool. There's no other way to explain it. And so I've been very fortunate to work with some huge names. And I think if I had anything to change about my career, I wouldn't change that. This has been a good time for me.
Yeah, especially since, of course, you can't really say you're a ghostwriter because your name's on the cover, which is fabulous. And you've had to write in many different kinds of styles. You know, Clancy's different with Cussler. And then, of course, your own novels, your Briggs Tanner series. Can you kind of talk, I mean, is chameleon the right word for you? Because you kind of have to change color maybe when you're kind of writing under the same thing. Does it kind of get a little confusing for you as you're having to do these things?
You know, the word you use, chameleon, other people have used that when talking about me, and I don't call myself that because it feels a little conceited, but yeah. Well, you know, I've had to become very adaptable and resourceful, and that's been just plain good for me as a writer, but also it's been a lot of fun. So, you know, when I'm writing an adventure book with Clive Cussler, that's one mindset. And when I switch to a Tom Clancy techno-thriller/political intrigue book, that's a different mindset. And having read all the people that I work with, I've got a pretty good foundation of what the reader wants out of that kind of book. So I'm able to switch those gears.
Well, how is the process working with those various authors different?
You know, it varies from author to author because, you know, to be frank, I mean, there have all been kind of bigger names on the cover, and rightly so. And so what we do, and we sit down and we first talk about the book, I kind of ask them, what are you most comfortable with? What's your style of doing things? And I try to tailor myself to how they like to do things, because that's just the way the deal is. Most of them are very, very flexible, and we come to a real agreement that works for both of us. Clive had his way, and Mr. Clancy had his, and Jim Rollins had his, and it all worked out in the end.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people like to know is when you're approached, you know, because like I said, you know, you're writing your Briggs Tanner series, and all of a sudden you get approached to do something like this. Do you kind of look back at it and say, why did you pick me? Was there something about the writing that they thought and they said, you know what, this is, you're the one that we have to do this? How was that process kind of at the very beginning when they came to you and asked you to be a part of this?
Well, you know, I'd done some true ghostwriting after the Tanner series for a couple books. And then in 2006 or 7, my editor came to me and said, you know, Clive is thinking about starting another series, and how would you feel about me throwing your name in the hat? And I probably gave that question, it must have been half a second of thought. And I said, please go ahead and throw my name in the hat. And the ball kind of started rolling after that. But I wouldn't say I got a reputation, but, you know, word got around that I can deliver the kind of book that you're looking for, hopefully, So it kind of took off from there. I've been very fortunate, and it's a humbling experience to be called by some of those people and get picked.
Well, John's mentioned Briggs Tanner's series. Who is Briggs Tanner?
Briggs Tanner is he was my original protagonist, and he kind of developed. It would be back in 1994 is when I first started putting him together and did an outline and things like that for the book that eventually became his debut, End of Enemies. And we're actually coming up on the 15-year anniversary of the publication and the first Briggs Tanner book, which,
wow.
And they're all out on digital now. But Tanner it's strange because Tanner works for an organization that is a lot like Tom Clancy's Campus. It's an off-the-books intelligence agency that works in that gray area where they do work, but they don't do work. They're acknowledged but unacknowledged. And so he's very much like Jack Ryan Jr. in that he works in that gray world. But he's a special ops guy, very resourceful, very stubborn, but he's got a really solid streak of humanity to him that I think the readers see when they read the Tanner books.
And there's just three of them, is that correct?
Just three?
What's that?
Yeah, there's just three of them, is that right?
That's right. There's three of them now. I get emails frequently to find out where Briggs Tanner is, and I kind of think of Briggs Tanner on an extended vacation, and he may reappear at any time.
And that was just going to be my next question. Fans are probably wondering, where the hell is this guy? Well, now we know he's on vacation somewhere. But he's hidden
somewhere. Yeah, in fact, I don't know where he is. He is not responding to any of my texts or emails, so I assume when he's ready to come back, he'll let me know. Yeah, I know. He's an independent fella.
I mean, do you ever get that itch, and do you ever sit down and figure out, like, a plot for maybe, you know, like a Clancy or something else coming? You're like, you know what, God, this would be perfect for Briggs. And I mean, does that happen?
It does, all the time. And, yeah, I think I'm waiting for the plot that will click and it will just, you know, speak his name. And I think it'll come eventually.
Yeah.
You should put him as a cameo in one of your other books here and see how many people catch it.
Kind of like Clive appearing in some of his own books. Yeah. That's,
exactly, yeah.
It's been done. Yeah.
That'll be good.
I'm kind of curious, Grant, what started you wanting to write?
You know, I think about this a lot. I think I must have been 8 years old or so, and I was just a kid, of course, but I'd been watching the Irwin Allen disaster series movies, you know, Earthquake and Towering Inferno and all that. I just love those movies. And so I decided in my infinite 8-year-old wisdom that I was going to write a novel, and it was going to be that kind of book. And I think I got about 4 pages into it of triple spaced lines, so it must have been 300 words, and I realized I had no idea what I was doing. And so I went out into the backyard and started playing with doodle bugs, and that was the end of my first foray into novel writing. Fast forward to 1987, July, I was 2 months out of the Navy, and, you know, I'd kind of gotten the spark while reading Mediterranean Caper by Clive. And I caught myself on a good day in July of 87, and instead of saying, well, tomorrow maybe I'll try, I hauled out a typewriter, and I started typing, and, you know, 28 years later, here I am.
Wow, a typewriter. I remember watching the Columbo episode, and they had a typewriter, and I'm like, and they were talking about how wonderful it was with the little ball, and I go, I bet you back in 1975, that was probably like great technology.
It was.
I remember,
you know, I was a poor, poor man back then, and I really, I ate a lot of ramen noodles, and the rest of my money went to paper and whiteout and ribbons for my typewriter, and that's where my
I was a bologna and cheese guy. I kind of was a poor bologna and cheese guy. That was me.
Well, see, that's because you were a little richer than I was.
I was too poor
for even bologna and cheese.
But see, the thing is that I could buy the bread, but I'd have to steal the bologna and cheese from my neighbor. So I would befriend them and
then
take their bologna. Yeah.
Well, that just means you're a survivor. That's all. You're well-bred for survival.
So you
remind me of that joke. The joke do you know the difference between a writer and a pepperoni pizza? And the answer is a pizza can feed a family of 4.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a toughie.
Yeah.
Well, I'm bringing it down to the real level there, Jeff.
Hey, Happy New Year. Yeah.
Thanks for just killing people's New Year's resolution dreams. You're not going to make money at the writer office if you're listening. Just know that right now.
Well, those that want to make it will just keep going anyway.
That's true.
There you go.
So, Grant, about your writing, is there one thing that, you know, from book to book when you're writing, regardless of who it is or what you're writing, is there something that you want to try to get better at? Is there one thing that you kind of see yourself like, you know, I really want to maybe get better at, you know, action scenes, dialogue, or whatever it is, something cautiously that you think about when starting a new book about that?
No, there's not anything conscious. I always say this, my guiding principle for everything I write is I want to entertain the reader. Readers pick up thrillers to be entertained, period. Now, if along the way they're enlightened or educated or their interest is piqued in a culture or whatever it might be, that's great. But if you're failing to entertain them, then, you know, you're not fulfilling your part of the contract. So that's kind of what is always in the back of my mind is, as a thriller reader also, would I enjoy reading this? And that's the question that kind of sits on my shoulder.
Got it.
So I'm going to do a scenario here with you, Grant. Your agent comes to you and says, Guess what? You can write in any franchise that you would like to write in. I can make the deal happen. What franchise would you like to write in?
You know what? Can it be in a franchise that does not yet exist?
Sure.
Okay, then it's got to be Wilbur Smith. Hands down, Wilbur Smith.
Why is that?
I didn't expect that one.
Yeah, I mean, he's hugely popular, Wilbur Smith is. He's kind of not a secret, but a secret in the thriller world. He's written a ton of books, and they mostly involve Africa, but he is just one of my favorite all-time thriller authors. I'd love to be able to work with him.
Oh, that's cool. And I'm a fan of his myself. I understand that. Yep.
Yep.
I have to say, and all the authors I've interviewed, hundreds of them, that's the first time Wilbur Smith's name has ever come up in a conversation. I have to say.
Is that right?
I've never heard. Yeah. I'm not even really sure who the hell it is. I got to check him out.
Yeah, you would love his books. Yeah, he's fantastic.
Huh.
Yeah,
no,
even my mother-in-law is a huge fan of his.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
She doesn't read thrillers, but she loves Wilbur Smith.
Wilbur, if you're listening, give me a call. I'm here.
Hey, Wilbur. Call us right now. You still got time. The phone number is 347-426-3764. Let's make it happen, Captain, right here on the radio.
Well, I mean, you know, the truth is Wilbur Smith is, I mean, he's such a giant in this business. He doesn't need anybody's help. But, you know, if he ever gets the itch, I'm sure he'd have a long line of authors who want to work with him.
Well, now the other thing we transition to, because you do a lot of work with the ITW, and, you know, you're involved in that organization a lot. When you were first starting out, just to kind of let new authors know, when you kind of went to the ITW and Thriller Fest for the first time, what was one of the biggest things that you took away that you can tell new people that are coming maybe to Thriller Fest for the first time for them?
Well, one of the great things is you're going to meet, you know, some of your heroes. You're going to meet people you never knew you wanted to meet, and they're all kind of in one place for one week in New York. But really, I think the biggest takeaway is if you're an aspiring author, you get to spend a week with people that get it. I mean, you get to spend a week with people that understand your drive to make things up out of whole cloth and put them between the covers of a book. And that's a really cool feeling to spend time with people that share that same obsession with you.
And now one follow-up real quick, though. What if they're nervous to go see maybe David Morrell or Steve Barry or Grant Blackwood? What would you tell them to do? Like, how would be the best way to maybe approach those people who they are fans of and they are very well respected?
I think it's, you know, all authors are just people. And I have, of course, people that I'm in awe of. But I think the best way is just walk up, introduce yourself, say, you know, I'm a fan. I've only met maybe a couple authors, big-time authors, who are not just down-to-earth and happy to talk to anybody. So just walk up and say hi and don't worry about it.
I was scared to meet you initially, just to let you know, but when I did meet you, you were such a nice person, and it's been awesome. So, thank you for
that. Why was I frightening? Did I have a look on my face, or did I emit some odor or something? Or?
I was a fan, and it was my first Thriller Fest, and as you said, you know, you're down to earth. And I didn't know what to expect when I was meeting authors that I really liked. And you were one of those folks who's like, there he is.
I appreciate that. And I actually do specifically remember meeting you, actually, yeah. And I remember thinking, this Jeff Ayers guy's a down-to-earth fella, too.
Oh, well, thank you.
I remember the first time when I was little and I met Hamburglar. I was really, really scared of McDonald's because I didn't know what to say. But he didn't say anything back until my mom had to tell me.
Well, that was a big bubble burst right there, wasn't it?
It was. I was like, damn it, there's a Hamburglar. And I walk up and I'm like, Hamburglar, how? She goes, no, honey, he's plastic. He doesn't talk. Oh.
Well.
The real one's
plastic.
Can I
have a Big Mac anyway? You know, that was just it. Then I'm just like, well, give me a Big Mac anyway. I don't
know. John, we're doing some really deep diving into your psyche here. I'm enjoying this.
I'll tell you what, there's a lot of deepness that I don't, there's a lot of deepness I wish stayed deep.
You don't want to go there, Grant, trust me.
All right, I'll leave it be.
Well, hey, Grant, so back to a question for you. I understand you're starting a new series, is that correct?
I am, I'm tinkering with it right now, and I hope to get writing here in a couple weeks. It's something that's been percolating in my head for, well, maybe 5 years now.
Awesome.
Can you give us a hint, or are you going to be doing other books and other franchises as well?
Well, I'm open-minded about any project that people come to me with because I enjoy doing that, and I've learned to never say no outright. You know, I will say this, is that my new character he works in a very dicey world, and he is saddled with, let me use the word impediment. He's saddled with an impediment that makes him both perfect and awful. at what he does. And readers will have to, I don't mean to tease too much, but readers will have to tune in to see exactly what I'm talking about. It will be, he will be a character, a thriller character that no one has ever read before, I'm sure.
Ooh, well, you know, yeah, I'll be reading it for sure.
Wow, nothing like teasing us now, and now we got to go. What the hell is
that
about?
Right.
Well, hey, we got about a minute left, or a little bit less than a minute. So what we want to do is give you the opportunity to kind of let people know, of course, you know, where they can find you out, your social media, website, the whole kind of gamut, 9 yards. Let them all know.
Sure. You know, the easiest thing is just to go out grantblackwood.com. My Twitter's on there. My Facebook is on there. You can reach out anyway. I read all my emails, answer all of them, hopefully. You know, and go out and check out Dead or Alive, or not Dead or Alive, excuse me, check out Under Fire Tomorrow. It's a very personal Jack Ryan Jr. book, and I think people will really enjoy following him on this adventure.
Well, especially fans of the whole Tom Clancy universe, because you just fit it right in, and that's great that you and Mark keep it going.
Yep.
Well, Grant, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. We'll see you in a little less than a month in New York City at Thriller Fest, and I'll make sure that this time I'll hold Jeff's hand when he comes up to say hi to you, and then you can just look at him and say, yeah, I know you, and then just walk away, you know, give him a cold hug.
I'll tell you what Jeff is afraid of. We'll ramp it up a little more, and we'll all share a little bro hug. How's that?
Right. And hey,
sounds
and
good.
If you want to dress up as, and if you want to dress up as Hamburger for me, that would be awesome. I can finally say hi to him.
Well, I just sent my wife a text actually to start working on the costume, so hopefully it'll be done by the time we get there.
All right. Well,
Jeff,
again,
John,
thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. It's been great.
All right, we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Good night,
guys.
Bye bye.
Good night. So, again, everybody, that is author Grant Blackwood. What a terrific interview, Jeff. Loved it. And you can visit grantblackwood.com for more information on that. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to catch our breath, and then we're going to come back to listen to the Nelson DeMille interview that we were supposed to have 2 weeks ago, but we were able to get him. And right in the middle of the part, you'll understand why he wasn't on last week or 2 weeks ago. And why we had to tape it now. So it's kind of interesting. So we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back after this.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Reichs, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlene Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
I'm
So welcome back, everybody, after the break. Again, we want to thank Grant Blackwood for coming on. That was a fabulous interview. But we also have to remind you of this, and that is that this month, Beyond the Cover, Suspense Radio is brought to you by New American Library, publisher of the most provocative thriller of the year called Eeny Meeny by M.J. Arledge. Lisa Gardner calls it an international, or calls it mesmerizing, and that's from an international best-selling author. Tammy Hogue also says White Knuckles guaranteed, and it is on sale now wherever books are sold. Don't forget it. Eeny Meeny by M.J. Arledge. Go check out the book now. We want to thank them so much for sponsoring the show for the month. And Jeff, are you ready?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go, everybody. Again, this was the interview that was supposed to happen 2 weeks ago, but it did not because of Nelson's schedule and whatnot, but you're going to hear it right now. So without any further ado, Nelson Dumel.
Okay, here we go, guys. So, Nelson, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Jeff, how you doing today?
Doing great.
So, Nelson, hope everything's good. We missed you on the show Beyond the Cover, but we're so happy that we're able to get you today to talk about your latest book, Radiant Angel. And it's the seventh book now in your John Corey series, the first one that you've written since 2012, which was The Panther. So let's just jump right in and just tell us what is, you know, what's going on right now in the book and with John Corey and everything.
Yeah, right. This is the seventh John Corey book. The first one about 15 years ago, I think it was Plum Island, which was meant to be a standalone book, just created the character John Corey. I'd never done a series, never wanted to. But, you know, readers loved this guy. Men loved him as a man's man. Women loved him. They thought he was sexy, whatever. It worked. And the publisher asked me to bring him back, so I did. And I got a job. His job was with the Anti-Terrorist Task Force. John was NYPD, homicide cop, retired, wounded in the line of duty. But he took his job as a contract agent, which a lot of cops do, with the federal government, working for the FBI. And that's what we saw him doing in the last five books. His beat was Islamic terrorism. But in this book, Radiant Angel, I've got him doing something different. He's now switched to transferred to the Diplomatic Security Group, and his job is to follow diplomats, in the UN diplomats in Manhattan, at the various missions, mostly bad guys, of course, like the Iranians and Chinese and Russians. And this book starts off with him on a Sunday morning and his trainee partner, a young woman named Tess Faraday, outside the Russian mission in the East 60s, and they're waiting for Colonel Petrov to come out. Colonel Petrov is SVR, which is the successors to the KGB, and it looks like a routine surveillance, but we know it's not, because if it was, there wouldn't be a book, so more happens.
Well, I sort of have to ask, because you keep having him in each book do something different. What is your research like for, I guess, the real task force?
Well, you know, I have some contacts on the task force, and they're located down at 26 Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan, and that's also FBI headquarters for the New York area. And some of these guys are retired. I mean, they tend to speak more easily when they're retired, and some are FBI, and they know that I'm fair with them when I represent them in the book, so they tend to be forthcoming. They like the good PR. I'm a little tough on the FBI, but it's fair criticism, I think, and they know it. And as far as the NYPD, who are part of the task force, they have lots of problems working for the feds, and that's part of each storyline. And they like to tell me about that. So, yeah, I went right to the... This is not the kind of thing you can research any place, not on the Internet or not anywhere else, not in books. So I went right to the source years ago when I created this character. And I think it's accurate. I've never gotten any complaints about inaccuracy. So John is NYPD, you know, kind of a wise mouth, and he's working with the FBI, who are kind of straight-laced and follow the rules. So... it's a good clash of cultures.
Now, Nelson, I first discovered you with the book Plum Island. That's how I first kind of got into your writing, was that book, and I found it fascinating. I actually listened to it as a book on tape and thought it was just so engaging, and then I kind of went back and started reading, you know, some of your other books. So when you kind of are out in the game and you're kind of doing, you know, these kinds of interviews and things, do you hear a lot of that? Do you always hear somebody says, yeah, I found maybe the general's daughter because of the movie or, you know, Charm School or Word of Honor, and then they kind of go back and then they kind of realize how many different things that you do write about, and they're kind of amazed at the catalog that you've created now with your writing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody has a different story, and they're all good stories. When I do book signings and talk to people, everybody has a good Nelson, my first Nelson DeMille story kind of thing. And that's why it's good that it's important for authors to have their books kept in print. Once they come out in hardcover, of course, they'll be, with luck, the publisher will keep them out in paperback forever and ever. Because each one of these is like an advertisement, and people just snag the book someplace in a beach house, and they read The Gold Coast or one of my other books, and they say, hey, I've never heard of this guy. I want to see the rest of his stuff. And now, with Amazon and Kindle, it's incredible how many books I sell through Amazon and Kindle, because people are looking at the book, as you say, this first time, and they're realizing that there's a whole body of work here, and they go right online and they order it. Can you just hold on just a second? Sorry. Come in, please. Sure.
This is why we love live radio interviews right here.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I knew that was going to happen. Thank you for that. Let me give you that. Okay. No. Yeah. No, no thanks. Yeah, you know, I just checked in here. I'm in Atlanta. I guess you know that. And
yeah.
I just came from, here you go. Thank you. Just came from Florida, and I did Miami and Vero Beach. So here I am.
There we go.
If it's Tuesday, what is today? If it's Thursday,
it's Thursday. It's a T. You got the T right.
It's Thursday. This must be Atlanta. All right, we're good to go.
Well, John mentioned his first book when he discovered you was Plum Island. Mine was Cathedral, and just was absolutely in love with that. And come to find out, I'd actually read Mayday when it was just Thomas's block name on the cover. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about Mayday, because I love the book, and then I found out later that you actually were a co-writer on that.
Right. Mayday was like 1980, I believe.
Longtime fan.
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, that that book is older than everybody I know except me. But it was the second book I've ever done. I was under contract with somebody else, the short of it was, and I wasn't supposed to do it. But Tom Block was a childhood friend, a U.S. Air pilot, one of their top pilots, but also a writer. He wrote for Flying Magazine. So one day, you know, over a couple of beers, as guys will do, we said, let's write a book together. And we started Mayday. We conceived of it and started writing it. I just had to check with my publisher, and I said, you know, they don't want to co-author the book, and So, you know, I took my name off of it for contractual reasons. But then years later, I put my name back on it, and it's okay. Now that my name is worth it more, I mean, that was part of the story. I wasn't really a big writer then. So now that I'm a big writer, the publisher's like, can we put your name back on a book, the one that we took it off of? I said, yeah, sure, whatever, you know. So now it's Nelson DeMille and Tom Block.
Okay. So one of the things you mentioned about John Corey, he's such a likable character, but he's also a bit of a wise ass and very politically incorrect at times. How do you balance that?
Well, I mean, he was a little bit over the top in a few of the books, and I've got some fan mail of people that maybe share my sense of humor. So I toned him down a little bit. He's getting a little bit older, as we all are, and he's a little bit toned down. So he's not like a joke a minute, but he knows how to use humor, I think, as kind of a sword. I mean, he kind of skewers people with the humor. He's not a slapstick guy. It's just very directed humor in many ways. And but it's just part of the territory. At NYPD, cop, you talk to these guys, especially the detectives, and this is what they say, how they speak, I should say. Because I do speak to them, and you just kind of listen. You know, you have to develop an ear when you're a novelist trying to create dialogue. And these are funny guys. So, because John Corey seems very quick, too. But an author has the advantage of being able to freeze time. When somebody says something to Corey, on the page. His reply is very quick and very sharp, and it looks like he just got it right off the top of his head. Now, it was me, the author, had to sit there for 10 minutes scratching my head saying, and what would he say? And then, of course, you seem very quick when you can freeze time like that. So, he's a man who sees the funny side of life, and he's kind of ironic in some ways. And at the same time, these are serious subjects, and that's the hard thing, is to weave the seriousness of the plot and storyline into this man's wise mouth.
Now, Nelson, you brought something up, because you mentioned that, you know, you thought John Corey was written maybe a little over the top, and you received some fan mail on that, so you kind of brought him back. With social media being so out there now and people using it all the time, and you get instant reaction now to your books, you know, I'm sure with Radiant Angel and everything that you bring out, do you let social media kind of maybe dictate a plot line or something into the future? Like, you know what, this is what I know people are interested about or talking about, and, you know, maybe influence your writing a little bit with the next book?
Well, that's a good question, and probably the short answer is no, because, first of all, it's kind of new. I mean, new to me anyway. I'm into social media now. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and even Instagram. But I think these things are just shot from the hip. But when people email me through my website, which is nelsondeville.net, the emails tend to be more thoughtful, and I absolutely listen. I mean, I've gotten some great ideas from my readers. Or if it's a snail mail, I really pay attention. As is rare these days, when you open an envelope that's got a stamp on it and you read a typed letter and there it is. And, you know, people have thought about that as opposed to, social media, which is, you don't know if this guy's in a bar and he's just, you know, mouthing off. You have no idea what's going on. But I do listen to the fans through my website and also through snail mail. And also, you know, even when I do book signings, people have thoughtful comments. And it can affect a little bit of how a character comes across. And it also can certainly give me an inspiration for a storyline now and then.
We were talking about series, and you didn't see John Corey as being in a series. And I know you've mentioned in the past that you didn't want to write any more Corey novels, but yet you have. I'm just wondering, has your feelings for Corey changed, and have you been writing them just because that's what your publisher wants?
Well, you know, I was getting kind of, I was thinking that the fans were getting tired of him, and maybe that was partly what I was reacting to. Every once in a while you get a letter, an email that says, you know, can we give Corey a break? And that's the ones you focus on. You always focus on the negative, and without looking at the other 15 that said, you know, we love this, we love this. I was getting a little bit tired of the guy, which is one of the reasons I gave him a slightly different job, and I also changed the direction of the plot, in terms of, well, not so much the plot, but the storyline, in terms of, it's not Islamic terrorism anymore. Now it's, you know, it's a resurgent Russia that he's concerned with in the new book, and I think that can rejuvenate the character. You got to do something, because you can't. Some writers, and we know who they are, write the same character time after time, you know, book after book for 15 years, and you can tell the character is getting tired of performing, and the readers are certainly getting tired. So you've got to do something to bring new life to these series. And one of the reasons I never wrote a series is I didn't want to get into this position. I love writing standalone books, but the Corey character is so popular that I wound up doing it. So if you're going to do it, you got to do it right, and you got to figure out how to do it so that the fans and are still interested in this guy after 7 books.
You know, this sort of leads into, you kind of just touched on the question I was leading into, because you have, you know, you do have Joe Riker and, of course, John Stutter, Paul Brenner, which was the general's daughter, which people remember was played by Travolta in the movie, and now John Corey. So when you're thinking maybe of a book and making it, do I make it a standalone, or would it fit within one of these series? Do you do that consciously, or do you just think of the plot and then you kind of fit it maybe in with one of these guys later, or is it just contractually bound? This is what I got to do this time.
Well, you know, with the Corey, not only the contract that makes me do the Corey ones, but, you know, when I know it's going to be Corey, because the time has come for a lot of reasons, usually having to do with sales and you know, it's just a time for another Corey, then, you know, the plot, of course, is going to be something to do with what he does for a living. But the standalones are all over the place. I mean, and you know my work. I mean, the first one was an Islamic terrorist book by the Rivers of Babylon back in 78 when nobody was writing about that. Then it was Cathedral by the Irish Republican Army. And then I went to a Cold War book, The Talbot Odyssey. I mean, I don't write, you know, genre. I mean, not only do I not write series usually, but I wasn't even writing genre. And I did, you know, two Vietnam books. I like to do something that I, you know, that I can spend a year of my life on, and that, you know, that interests me. Because if I'm interested, I'm sure that the reader's going to be interested. So I'm always looking for something new. I think I can create these worlds. A lot of writers, unfortunately, are a little bit lazy. They've already created the world. They've done their research. And they don't want to get out of their comfort zone, but I'm okay. I'm happy with the challenge of writing something totally different every time, which was a criticism years ago. Even my publisher said, "You're writing you're not even saying what the genre. You're not even known as the Cold War writer or the Vietnam writer or the mystery writer." And I said, "No, and I'm not. And I don't want to be." So this is one of the reasons I resisted the series. But okay, the series is okay. It's not a bad thing. And I think if the readers are happy, and they're obviously happy, every John Corey book becomes a huge bestseller. And so I'm not doing it for me so much as I'm doing it for the people who want to read John Corey.
Well, you also talk about controversial subjects in your books, and I remember specifically Flight 800, Nightfall. Has you tackling controversial subjects been a problem for you?
In what way? I mean, in terms of criticism? No, not really. TW-800 was the only one that I was a little bit concerned about. The name of the book was Nightfall. I fictionalized what I thought might have happened with TW-800. You know, that was a plane that blew up 1996 over the south shore of Long Island, killing all 270 people on board. It was a 747. And there was a lot of speculation about what might have happened. A lot of people were not satisfied with the conclusion. This is sort of like the Kennedy assassination, where you have a commission that has a conclusion, and the conspiracy theorists don't believe a word of it. And somewhere in between lies the truth. And I wasn't sure myself. I live on Long Island, and I knew people who actually saw what happened that night. So it always interested me. My daughter actually had been on the same flight 800 2 days before on a Sunday night going to Paris. I drove it to the airport. So, you know, I had a kind of interest in it, but I didn't really want to exploit the tragedy. I didn't want to base an entire novel on a real incident the way people do with, like, the Kennedy assassination or the Lindbergh case, where, you know, you're fictionalizing, you know, a tragedy. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought there was so many different angles here that really needed to be dealt with, maybe in fiction form. So, you know, when I sat down to write it, I did, you know, did my research under the Freedom of Information Act. I got a bunch of transcripts from witnesses that were taken by the FBI of what the people saw that night. And the more I got into it, the more interested I got. So, but there was a little blowback on that. But not a lot, a little bit blowback, again, about exploiting a tragedy. But I think the thing came to the, you know, surface again, the whole controversy. And still hasn't been put to bed. I don't think a lot of people believe that it was an accident. I think people believe it was a missile that took the plane down. And I don't know if we'll ever find out. But you know, the book got mostly good reviews. And it got some attention of the government. One congressman on Long Island raised the issue again because of the book. So that was good.
The one thing I would say, aside from going, of course, to nelsondemille.net, which people can find out all the information they want to find out about your books and everything else, you are going to be attending Thriller Fest this year as the Thriller Fest Master. This is one of the things that, you know, I'm not sure how long they, you know, you talked about this, but can you talk about kind of how that came about, where now you're going to be at Thriller Fest this year and you are the man of the hour?
Yeah, well, my good friend Lee Child asked me, gosh, it was back in January or February, if I wanted to be the Thriller Master for, I thought he was talking about, you know, like the week after next or something, but it turned out that I was a recent member of the International Thriller Writers, who these are the people who give out the award. I hadn't been a member for the first 8 or 9 years since it was started, but it's a very successful organization. So I was kind of surprised that they asked me, about a year after I joined. So, of course, I said yes. It's an honor. And I also mentioned that I had never been given an award before, but there's not too many awards in this business, so you don't really expect awards. But it sounded interesting. And Lee Child and I, this might interest you, we're members of a round table that meets the first Tuesday of every month. There are five or six, seven, we really have about 10 authors, and we don't all show up because we can't, but Harlan Coben is another one, and Lee Child, me, Susan Isaac, Linda Fairstein, Mary Higgins Clark, and we sit around in the same restaurant every week, every first Tuesday of the month, and complain about our agents and our editors and the publishing business, and we're all successful, of course, but people are people, you know, this is how people are. So, best-selling authors sitting together, complaining about who knows why. We have nothing to complain about, really. We know that. But it's kind of fun. And at one of those sessions, after a couple of drinks, Lee asked me if I wanted to be the Thriller Master of the Year. So, and a drink later, I said yes. Yeah.
Well, I need to move to the New York area and find that restaurant. But actually, I'm going to be moderating the panel you're going to be on at Thriller Fest, and I cannot wait for that. You actually have a bit of news. I was going to say that I did see that you're the that Radiant Angel is number one on the USA list, and I think that's the first time for you for that. But you
yes.
also are number one on the New York Times list. Is that correct?
That's correct. I just got the word late last night, actually, and it'll be coming Sunday. I will be number one not only on the print list, but also on the ebook list, and then the New York Times keeps a combined list. So there's actually three bestseller lists now. You're not always necessarily in the same spot on each one, but Radiant Angel debuted at number one in all those three categories, print, ebook, and combined ebook print. So that was great, and we're really thrilled. It's good news to get when a book comes out and when you're doing publicity for it. It keeps you going, so to speak.
Well, that's just wonderful. Congratulations. I'm curious, what is your writing process like? And also, does your publisher sort of push for a book a year? I know a lot of authors do that, and you don't. I'm just kind of curious.
They absolutely do push for a book a year, and sometimes I'm tempted to give them a book a year, but it's not going to be the book they want, you know? And I take a long time on my books. That's why they're so successful. I know what I'm doing, and I'm a little bit of a slow writer, but more than that, I'm a little bit of an obsessive writer, and I do maybe six drafts. Plus, I do a lot of research, and then I triangulate my research and make sure everything's right. You know, we all make mistakes. I've made a few mistakes in, you know, presenting facts that people have given me, but basically, I get it right. You know, years ago, writers used to write every 2 or 3 or 4 years. I mean, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, this whole idea of a book a year, it's a little bit insane. I mean, it's a marketing thing. And, you know, look, if a writer can do it, fine, but without the quality suffering is what I'm getting at. I think the quality of mine would suffer because I know how I am. There are other writers, I'm sure, who are very, prolific, and they can. And also, some writers are not doing a lot of research because they don't have to. It's the nature of their plot or their storyline. Maybe that they don't need to do a lot of research. So it's possible to do a book a year. But not for me, and I just, say no, although, they do pressure me, but I decided every 14, 16 months is a good, and also it gives me time to have fun.
Well, Nelson, first we want to thank you again for being on here. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you, and we're so happy that we were able to catch up. Instead of on Monday, but this has been fascinating. So I just have one more question left before we let you go,
sure.
Because we know that your schedule is very busy. You mentioned Lee Child, so I got to know, Reacher versus Corey, who wins?
Nobody's ever asked me that before. Well, obviously John Corey, but somebody suggested I put some of these characters, that we all put some of these characters together, which I think some of these guys have done. Some of the bigger name authors for charity in their short story anthologies, and I think it's been done before.
Yeah, they just did the face-off one for Thriller Fest. That was
right,
last
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I don't know. I think bottom line, Corey is a tough guy, but you know, Reacher is obviously a man who's, you know, who knows who he is. I have to think about that. I'm not gonna. Whatever I say is gonna be wrong, but I will say Corey just so I can say something.
Well, hey, again, we want to thank you so much for coming on, Jeff, and this has been an absolute pleasure. So, good luck. Congratulations.
Thanks,
on number one. We will see you at Thriller Fest. I'll make sure I come up and say hello to you. And again, it's been a pleasure. So, have a great one.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate
thank you
it.
So much.
Okay. Bye
bye. Bye
bye. And there you go, everybody. The Nelson DeMille interview. That was supposed to happen 2 weeks ago, but it's happening now. We got a couple minutes left on the show, and Jeff and I were talking off air, and Jeff has a couple books that he wants to talk about real quick. So, Jeff, go right ahead and do it up. You got 2 minutes.
All right. Well, actually, I just have one, but I
got
to tell you.
Then you only got 1 minute.
I know. goodbye. I picked this up in New York, and I'm absolutely loving this book. It's called Every Second, and the author is Rick Mafina. And I love
Rick's
books.
Oh, I love
Rick. Yeah. So the basic premise is that four armed men force bank manager Dan Fulton to steal $250,000 from his branch, because he's a bank manager. And to get him to do it, they strap remote detonation bombs on him, his wife, and their young son. And he basically steals the money, but that's only the beginning of his quest to save his family. And there's also a news reporter who picks up on the story that this manager has robbed his own bank. And as she starts investigating it, she starts discovering, wait a minute, something else is going on. And it is surprising and chilling, and I love it. Love it, love it, love it. Every
second. Be one of those, I think Rick has got to be one of those authors that's underappreciated, a great author that's never really mentioned with the big thriller writers, and I think that that's kind of a disservice because his books are wonderful.
He is one of the best authors out there, and you're absolutely
yeah.
right. He doesn't get what
yeah.
he deserves here, so hopefully this one will put him in the stratosphere.
Well, hey, Jeff, we are going to be back in 2 weeks with our friend Patrick Lee. He's going to be on the show talking about his latest book. And then we are taking a sabbatical in July because we're going to have some conferences that we're going to be doing, and we're going to come back. I think our next guest is Kevin O'Brien. But you can check all that out by going to SpenceRadioNetwork.com, clicking on Beyond the Cover, seeing the show schedule, and make sure if you have any questions, you can always email us at editor@SuspenseMagazine.com. So, Jeff, it's been another great show. See you soon, my man. We're going to see you in about less than a month.
That's right. Looking forward to it.
All right. Good night, everybody. See you in 2 weeks with Patrick Lee.